This is Rabbi Jeff Sachs of Atid and Web Yeshiva with another installment in Jews, Judaism, and Modernity, our Jewish history course, looking at another chapter in the history of the Jews of Russia and the attempt to forcibly bring them into the Haskalah. It's actually a quite sad story we have tonight. As if the stories that we, have been looking at in the last few weeks were really happy ones. They weren't. This is sad for a different reason. This is a tragedy of a different kind. There is. I just one point I wanted to mention that somehow fell off the radar last week. Last week we talked about the Cantonist system. And altogether, the Jews in the Soviet army, not the Soviet army, I'm sorry, the Russian army. And it wasn't just, it wasn't, of course, just in Russia. It was a question of Jews going to the army in other places as well, in Galicia, in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, later even in Germany. In World War I, of course, Jews served in the German army, etc. There was, although it's the kind of thing where we don't have any kind of statistical evidence or numbers or things like that, you know, the kind of hard data that historians love. But apparently there was this really sad phenomena of Jews maiming themselves in order to get an exemption from having to go to the army, to these long stretches of army service. And again, we saw, you know, these situations where, in theory at least, you know, a boy might have been chapped to go off to the Cantonists at the age of 8 or 9, even though the system technically only wanted them from the age of 12. And they were there until they were 18, and only then did they start their 25 years of army service. So this very sad situation of people physically harming themselves, or trying to make themselves weak, or you know, by through malnutrition or other things, you know, I guess things that in theory might have been reversed once they became exempt from the army, or other cases of literally maiming themselves by losing a finger or a part of a foot or things like that. There is all types of anecdotal evidence for such things, but I think it heightens the real horror of what it meant to go to the army. After the, in other words, if Nicholas the First wanted to make the Jews more receptive to Christianity, the Cantonist system wasn't really a very effective method. You know, the children that were taken off, well, probably a lot of them did convert. Probably a lot of them just died. So I guess technically there were fewer Jews in the world, but there weren't more Christians. However many went, and at the end of the last session we talked a little bit about the statistics of the system, but that still left lots of millions of Jews, who were still very much engaged with traditional Jewry. So if he wanted to kind of move them away from that, the Cantonist system wasn't a terribly effective way to go about doing it. In Western Europe, which we discussed in the last round, in the last semester, in Western Europe, reform was a function of education. Reform was fostered through education, through secular education. In Russia, there was this very strong conservative tendency, not conservative, the conservative movement, I mean conservative with a lowercase c, shamrani, a very strong resistance to anything that smacked of secularism. And this was for, you know, all of the reasons that we discussed earlier, having something to do with the way that the general non-Jewish society was perceived. And the difference is how a Jew in Russia viewed his surrounding society versus, let's say, a Jew in cosmopolitan Berlin or in Germany or in Paris. In Russia, even though public education was open to the Jews and there were very many incentives to encourage them to take advantage of that, very few do, because it ipso facto involved being educated in, it being indoctrinated in Russian Orthodox Christianity. And that was something that wasn't really very appealing to the masses of traditional Eastern European Jewry. Yes, let me just check. Were the Jews mixed in the army population or the old Jews? The Cantonist units for the youngsters, they were, I believe, all, you know, essentially Jewish, although the officers themselves were not Jewish. And then once they entered the regular army, they were mixed in with the regular population. This fellow here that we're looking at on the screen, Count Sergei Uvarov, 1786 to 1855, was an extremely high-placed figure in Russia. His official title at his height was something called the Deputy Minister of Public Education. Something like, you know, a sense of like the Secretary of Education or the Minister of Education. He was right up there, a very senior advisor to the Tsar. He coins this phrase, which becomes the slogan of Tsarist Russia: Orthodoxy, Autocracy, and Nationalism. The chant, the slogan of a very closed authoritarian allegiance to the Tsar. By Orthodoxy, he doesn't mean, you know, Agudas Yisrael. He means Orthodoxy, Russian Orthodoxy. In the 1830s, he, on some kind of a visit to the West, he was very surprised to see assimilated Western Jews. It was remarkable to him to discover that there was such a creature in Prussia or in Germany or wherever it was. And he's told by his hosts that it's a function of the Haskalah, of the Jewish Enlightenment, of the Jews being exposed to general studies and to secular learning, which then become stepping stones and open the doors to all types of other social advancement, etc. And in 1840, he begins a campaign to start secular schools for Jews in Russia, with the help or with the assumption that the Jewish maskilim, the Jewish Enlightenment figures, would be helpful to him and would be partners to this, realizing that if the Russian government tries to impose this top down, it won't be successful. It has to be something that has some kind of grassroots support from within the Jewish community. And he enlists the support of Max Lilienthal. Here's Max Lilienthal, who is really a very tragic figure. He's a very well-meaning person, but he, as we will see in the course of our conversation this evening, he's apparently somewhat naive. Max Lilienthal is somebody that had a storied career both in Western Europe, in Eastern Europe, and then afterwards in America, where he becomes a very significant player in Cincinnati. I'm going to say Cincinnati, but something's telling me Cleveland. But I'm pretty sure it's Cincinnati in the reform movement in the United States. And you can find plenty of information about him besides the one little chapter of his life we're going to be discussing tonight. You can find, of course, much more online. Max Lilienthal is from Munich, is from Germany, German Jew of pedigree, university educated. He has a PhD, and he's also a rabbi. And he's recommended to Uvarov as someone that could be a partner in starting public education in Russia. He had on his own established a school of sorts in Riga in Latvia at the request of certain wealthy Jews, merchants of some sort. That was in 1840. In 1841, when he's quite young, he's born in 1815. So in 1841, he's what? He's 25. He's 25. He's 26. He was asked to create a system for the entire secular school system, a Jewish secular school system, for the entire Pale of Settlement. And he's at first suspicious. Why does the Tsar suddenly want to educate all of these illiterate Jews, if he's not educating the illiterate Russian masses, his own people? This causes some alarm to go off in his mind, and he's assured that it's the first step towards ultimately emancipating the Jews. He's assured that the whole idea is really with the best interests of the Jews, at heart. So he makes this grand tour of the Pale of Settlement to study it and to drum up support. And he's, of course, very much mistrusted by the Jews he encounters, who are even more suspicious than he is. They think he's a traitor. They feel that he might be a partner to their enemies, when in fact he was at best probably just a puppet. He was really just misled and naive. There's some interesting evidence of his encounter with the Tzemach Tzedek, one of the previous Lubavitcher Rebbes, and what he had to say about it. Is Rafi online with us? Rafi, I think you once sent me something about that encounter. I tried looking for it on my computer, but I couldn't find it. I don't know if you have it. If you have it, you can resend it. If it was a link, you can send it to everyone. He in 1843, Uvarov and Lilienthal put pressure on a committee of four Jewish communal leaders, a Misnagdic leader, a Hasidic leader, a lay leader, and a educational leader, a figure in education. The Misnagdic leader was Rabbi Yitzchak of Volozhin. The Hasidic leader was Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson, not the Rebbe that you all know from Chabad, the previous Rebbe, but the previous Rebbe Menachem Mendel Schneerson, and trying to convince them that they should get behind the program and that the goal isn't against Judaism per se, but to try to advance the Jews. And the whole thing is again viewed as very suspicious, and it's viewed as a kind of top-down Haskalah, as opposed to the way it works in Western Europe. In Eastern Europe, it is viewed as what was called a haskalah mitam, or haskalah mitam hamemshala, that it was an imposed enlightenment, which is, of course, some kind of oxymoron. You can't impose enlightenment on someone. It's the kind of thing that has to sprout up from within the person or from within the community. In 1844, there are two edicts. One is a public edict, and one is a private edict, meaning it's a decision on behalf of the government, but it's not made public to people. The public edict was that that there would be crown schools for the Jews, that there would be state-sponsored and financed schools for the Jews, that would involve the removal of the old-style cheder, the old-style melamed, and it would be replaced with Russian language instruction and all of the things that you would imagine out of a desire to really curtail the cultural autonomy that the Jewish community had experienced and benefited from up until then. The incentive to send your children to the school was that it exempted him from the army. Now, this is after the cantonist system has been abandoned, but even after the cantonists, when you turn 18, you still have to go off to the army for potentially a really long time. But if you go to the schools, you're exempt. So that's a really good carrot. That's a good incentive to send your kids. And still it doesn't work. Which says no matter how suspicious we are of the army, we're even more suspicious of these public schools. Most of the principals in these schools themselves were Christian, were Russian Orthodox Christian, and they, the principals, appoint the teachers. Even though the cheder, interestingly, the cheder and the yeshiva gedola, which correspond, you know, to elementary school and high school more or less, were not abolished. These institutions existed in parallel. And at a certain point, the cheder system and the yeshiva system become somewhat oppressed. They still exist side by side with these state schools. The private edict that was issued at the same time in 1844 said explicitly that the goal of this school system is to bring the Jews nearer to Christianity, is to ultimately lead them to conversion. At a certain point, the private correspondence between Nicholas and Uvarov becomes public somehow, and then the jig is really up. You know, whatever numbers of Jewish families were sending their kids to this school, after this private correspondence becomes public, the numbers really drop, so that in 1850, the only statistic I have is that in 1857, there were only 3,293 Jewish kids in the whole pale of settlement, in these schools. In 1848 already, Uvarov had quit this position because he saw that it wasn't working. Not that he was won over to the love of the Jewish people. He wasn't. He just saw that the whole plan didn't work. By 1845, Lilienthal himself leaves Russia. Apparently, you know, according to the story, some Russian official asked him when he was going to convert. You know, you can imagine they're at I'm telling the story like the way I would tell it if we were making a movie about his life. I don't think this is the way it actually happened. You know, they're at a cocktail party, and, you know, some minister in the Russian government says to him, "Oh, Max, you know, have you converted yet?" And Lilienthal, like, you know, his face blanches. He says, "What are you talking about? And he says, "No, we all assume, of course, that you're with us. Wink, wink, nod, nod, nudge, nudge. You know, aren't you going to accept the cross? Isn't that what this is all about?" You know, and you see, like, you know, the light bulb going on over his head. Now, probably the realization was, you know, that's the way we've dramatized it for the made for TV movie. You know, of Max, which Hollywood actor are we going to get to play Max Lilienthal? Who does he look like? You can see, like, I don't know, Judd Hirsch, you know, with a white powder wig, something like that. Some, like, you know, older Jewish actor. And he realizes that the whole thing has been one big ruse, and that he's been duped. And he leaves, and he at that point goes to America in 1845, and he's in America for almost 40 years, where he has this second chapter in his career, which is similarly interesting, but not our topic for tonight. He writes in he was quite prolific. He writes at some point the following. He says, "Only when the Jew will bow down to the Greek cross," Greek cross meaning the Russian Orthodox cross, "only when the Jew will bow down to the Greek cross will the Tsar be satisfied, irrespective of whether the converts be good or bad people." And he realizes that he's been duped. And in that case, it's a really very tragic story. There's this interesting letter that we have, which is written in 1841, before he spends about 5 years more or less in Russia. The whole experiment takes place over the course of 5 years, from like around 1840 to 1845. So this is a letter from 1841 that he writes. This is in an old essay from the 30s, which is a collection of his correspondences. Somebody discovered in an archive and published them in the 1830s. This is a letter that he's writing to Rabbi Dr. Levi, probably, in Bavaria, in Germany. And this is the letter that he writes, meaning he's describing what's going on back to, I guess, an old colleague back in Germany. So he says, "It will be 4 weeks by the time you receive this letter that I will have been in St. Petersburg, under the commission of the government to learn its plans in reference to a moral, intellectual, and religious improvement of our co-religionists. He says, I'm here to study how to improve our fellow Jews morally, intellectually, and religiously." And religiously. So, like, the commission that he's given, it sounds like something that he should be involved with. He says, "Well nigh 2 million of our people languish in a condition of wretchedness unknown to us." There's 2 million Jews here, and it's really bad. You can't compare the condition of the Jews in the Pale of Settlement to what it's like for us back in Germany. "They groan beneath a burden of poverty of which we Germans have not even a conception." That's interesting. He's writing a letter to another rabbi in Germany, and he refers to them as "we Germans," which is something that Russian Jews would never do. They'd never refer to each other as, you know, "we Russians." They would, you know, they'd say, you know, "we Yidden," or whatever they would say. But it indicates a completely different mindset. He says, "The poverty here in Eastern Europe, it's something that we Germans have not even a conception. Bear the ignominy of the Middle Ages, which we have long since forgotten." He says, it's like the Middle Ages here. They live in a this is an antiquated English translation of the letter. The letter itself is written in German, and in the 1930s, it's translated into English. So he says, they live in a Hasidic intellectual darkness, in a Hasidish darkness, in the choshech of the Hasidic intellectual milieu, which is just belying his own prejudices, which kills mind and heart and presents a picture of misery and wretchedness which surpasses all pictures of the most terrible imagination. So we see that Lilienthal himself bears certain kind of bourgeois, Yekish German prejudices against the Ausjuden, the Eastern European Jews. Yet all these, so in other words, there's, you know, he's duped by the Russians, but it's not that he doesn't have a prejudice of his own. Not to compare lahavdil elif alfei avdalot, not to compare his prejudices against the Eastern European Jews to those of Yuvarov. Yet all these fetters are to be removed. He says, but here's the good news. We're going to cast off this bad situation for these Jews. His Majesty the Emperor has favored the plan of the high-minded Minister of Education, Yuvarov, to emancipate the Jews. But they are to obtain this imperial gift only on condition of a thorough intellectual and moral education. 200 schools are to be opened throughout the empire, elementary, city, and high schools. The young people who pass through these schools are to receive all the rights of citizenship without trammel. This is a great and glorious thing, the like of which our history has not yet produced. Not a too sudden deliverance from the bonds of the Middle Ages without being able to make use of the freedom as happened in France. Not a restless exhortation and struggle without obtaining the least advantages as in Germany. No, the exalted desire of the monarch is for education and emancipation, for culture and the rights of man. He says, chick-chock, it won't even be like we in Western Europe, we had a fight for it, and it was difficult, and it was a long process. So here, you know, you get your bus pass, you get on the bus, you go to PS, 52, you show up at school with your lunchbox, you study reading, writing, arithmetic, and boom, we'll be emancipated, and it'll be like jumping light years from the Middle Ages to the modern era, which of course it wasn't, and it was never intended to be, and it's shocking to imagine that anybody could have been so naive, but it's also an interesting thought experiment to imagine what would have it meant for any community, Jewish or otherwise, to make a light year jump like that culturally. I mean, the idea that anybody could have imagined that a massive, massive, massive community of millions of people could be brought from the Middle Ages to the modern period. The modern period, of course, here being the mid-19th century, with everything involved, is just gross naivete. But the men who are to be placed at the heads of these different institutions are wanting. So he's writing back to this fellow in Germany, and he says, but we need people, we need a few good men to man this operation. Russia has them not. Germany shall furnish them. Meaning, you know, we need enlightened Jews to serve as role models, to serve as teachers, to serve as head of schools. Men who feel called upon to take part in this great work are the regeneration of their people, will, in ensuring the happiness of their brethren, lay the foundation of their own good fortune. Appointed and paid by the state as officials of the state, protected by the state against the blind opposition of the unthinking fanaticism, a future brighter than they can ever hope for in Germany awaits them. So he says, we need to draft people, German Jews, who are we going to look to be these folk, if not our German Jewish brothers and cousins, to come and, you know, make this all happen in Russia. And I mean, there's no place else to look besides Germany. In Bavaria, there's a great number of young men who have finished or are about to finish their studies and are unable to earn their living in Germany. So this is perfect. It's Zenen ev Zenen. You have all these people that became these enlightened German Jews in Germany. And what are they going to do? How many enlightened Jews can you employ? How many school teachers do you need? So we'll ship them to Russia. And in Russia, they'll lead the next wave, and they'll become the leaders. I think of them with real pleasure because I'm able to prove by deed that I will gladly do anything to make them happy and have them provided for. Now, since I may hope that you, Reverend Sir, will not refuse me your active cooperation, both on account of your love for these men and also your zeal for our great and holy cause, I venture to make the following request. So here's what I'm asking for you, of you, Rabbi Levi. I do not know the addresses and homes of all these unengaged men. If I did, I would have written to them personally and saved you the trouble. But since the express wish of the minister, this matter is not to appear in public journal before its consummation, and I therefore may not make any public appeal, I beg you most urgently to write these men immediately. He says, I need a recruiting agent back home that can draft these folks that are going to pack up their bags and come and be the hands and hearts and eyes and minds of the Eastern European, Enlightenment. I'll skip ahead. The cause is a great and holy one, and therefore I count upon your enthusiastic cooperation. Even though the trouble and labor that the matter will cost you be great, it is a great work. Your reward and the gratitude and appreciation of your contemporaries and posterity will be greater, blah, 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 etc., etc., etc. I remain Preacher Dr. Lilienthal. Let me just check. What are you? Is it an issue with it? Yeah, no, I think it's clear. He says that this he's acting on behalf of the minister. He's acting on behalf of you, Ruff. They understood they needed to send somebody. They needed to have people that would be able to come. The schools couldn't only have been staffed by Russians, by Christians. You needed to have some Jews in the classroom. First of all, because these kids didn't speak Russian. You had to teach them. You had to have people that could speak to them in a common language. And then also because it would have looked, extraordinarily suspicious, even though the schools were headed by non-Jews. So no, it was obvious that he was acting on behalf of the authorities. Again, the whole story, the whole episode of Max Lilienthal is again a tragic one. But by tragic, again, I mean tragic in the sense of a Greek tragedy. The Cantonist system is a catastrophe, but it's not a tragedy, because there's no one with the tragic. There's no tragic hero. Here, Lilienthal is a real tragic hero, and it's all brought about because of his tragic flaw, which is a naivete. And perhaps the lesson of Lilienthal is the suspicion of these, what's viewed as these very backward, unenlightened, medieval Hasidic Jews, although they, of course, weren't all Hasidim, that these so-and-so unenlightened medieval Dark Age Jews, as perceived by the enlightened German Jew, what could they possibly know? But their almost instinctive suspicion and lack of trust was actually really well founded. And Lilienthal's trust and belief in the power of enlightened ideas was misplaced when granted to a Haskalah mitam, when granted to the Russian imposed Haskalah, which in fact was really coming with very, very real ulterior motives. When all other attempts, the idea that we can contain the Jews in one area and open up somehow forcibly with a heavy hand, either with a carrot or with a stick, turn them into farmers, that would reform them, or the Cantonist system, or imposed education through the systems that we discussed this evening, when all of these systems fail to assimilate the Jews, there's really only two options available. One is to emancipate them. One is to make them full citizens, which is, you know, ultimately what opened the floodgates to assimilation in Western Europe, to emancipate the Jews. But that's inconceivable. That would have required a complete reorientation and a fundamental modernization of Russian political thinking. Again, in Russia, they didn't emancipate their own people. They didn't emancipate the Russian peasants, the Russian serfs, until the 1860s. In the 1840s, they're going to emancipate the Jews? It was inconceivable. So since that door isn't open to them, since all the attempts until now have failed, and the one thing that would have done it, the one thing that would have paralleled the quote-unquote success of Western Europe, which was to emancipate the Jews, was just not on the table in Russia. There's only one other option. What is that? Right, well, Sherry writes to kill them off or kick them out, although that's not necessarily always possible. I mean, if it's in the middle of the 19th century and you have 2 million plus Jews in your borders, it's not really possible to kick them out, both from a technical point of view, I mean, the amount of manpower and administrative wherewithal to undertake a project like that, of literally forcing them out. What are your neighbors going to say? Like, where are you going to kick them out to? And why would your neighbors want them? And why wouldn't your neighbors respond very unwelcomely to that? So that's not really possible. Killing them off is also not possible in the same way that we now think of as the Holocaust, because that also requires a massive operation that only a modern military could have undertaken. Well, to convert them, how are you going to convert them? In other words, you can convert them, you know, do a mass conversion and say, hocus pocus, you're all Christian, but lemaisa, the next day, they're all going to wake up and put on tefillin. So that doesn't work. I mean, it didn't work in Spain. It's not going to work. It's not going to work here. And it's a much, much, much larger population spread out over a much larger area than was in Spain. No, so they were kicked out of Spain. Brian says, but they were kicked out of Spain. So yes, that's true. But they were kicked out of Spain. It was a much smaller population in much more densely focused areas of settlement. And Spain was in a position in 1492 to do that. Spain was the superpower, and if they kicked people out, if they kicked the Jews out and the Jews went to wherever they went to, so their neighbors at that point really couldn't do much. Remember, 1492, Spain has, Isabella and Ferdinand have reconquered the entire peninsula and are in a very, very strong position, which is why they're able to spend money to send a guy named Columbus sailing around the world, and which is why they can say, well, we've cleaned things up at home, now we have to get rid of these Jews. Russia's not in that position in the 19th century to do that. It's just not possible to undertake, wouldn't be possible to undertake a project like that. But James writes, did this naivete create a historical foundation for the pogroms and ultimately the Holocaust? I'm not sure what you mean by the naivete, but in other words, this idea of there are no more options, what we've tried in the past hasn't worked. The only effective option would have been to choose emancipation, but that's not conceivable. So you see the rise of a real strong anti-Semitism. There's always an underlying tone of anti-Semitism, but now it really begins to bubble up. It begins to bubble up in Eastern Europe. It also bubbles up in Western Europe, where the Jews have been emancipated and still, darn it, are Jewish. From this point on, from the early mid-19th century up until the mid-20th century, or 1939, 1940, and on, the rise of anti-Semitism in its different forms becomes the focus of what's happening. That will give rise to internal movements in the Jewish community, most significantly to Zionism. Most significantly to Zionism, a sense that we don't belong here. And all of our attempts to reform ourselves or to make ourselves more like the people around us, or, you know, what have you, haven't solved the problem because they're still trying to kill us. And we need a different solution. We need a different solution, and that is the Zionistic solution. But, of course, there are other internal phenomena that are reactions to that, as we will see as we proceed. The way anti-Semitism in the East plays out versus anti-Semitism in the West is very interesting, and a comparison of the two is really called for, because they arise partially for different reasons. They play themselves out in different reasons, and they may have actually really been motivated by different causes, and trying to uncover those causes is essential to understanding what's happening to the Jewish community in the East and the West. This is a somewhat artificial division to make this line of demarcation to say, you know, in the East you have Poland and Russia, and in the West you have France and Germany. But it's an effective one. It's an effective shorthand to understand these different phenomena, and that's what we're going to be getting into a little bit. I apologize. Next Tuesday, I were unable to have class on next Tuesday. I had thought that maybe we could meet on a different night, but it seems that there are too many conflicts with other Web Yeshiva classes. So unfortunately, I think we're going to have to skip a week, and we'll pick it up again in 2 weeks from now. I will nevertheless try to send out something, perhaps a short essay or article for you to read, by way of introduction to our discussion of anti-Semitism, which will start next time we meet, which will be in 2 weeks from tonight. So for tonight, that's all. If you have any questions, I will, of course, be happy to stay on and chat.